Hi, this is Allison Sheridan of the NoSilicast podcast, hosted at podfeet.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever so slight Macintosh bias. Today is Sunday, August 23rd, 2009, and this is show number 220. Well, it's nice to be back in the saddle again with all the goofballs in the live chat room, but I gotta tell you, it's way easier to do this without, help? I knocked that show out last week in like 17 minutes. It was amazing. Oh, wait. Now that I remember, I didn't do much of the recording. Everybody else did the work. Maybe that's why it was so much faster. I do like the company here. I really do. It's a lot of fun in the chat room. If you guys haven't ever been there before, check it out at, I've now got it on my own website. So podfeet.com/live, really easy to remember. It's trying to get the time zones and stuff. That's at 5 p.m. GMT minus 8 on Sundays, which is actually Monday in Australia, but I'm not going down that road again. All right, we ought to get started here. Back on show number 217, on August 2nd, I did a review of some super cool software that I really like called Voila, and the awesome developer I worked with on it, Guru, offered up two free copies of Voila to lucky NoSilicast listeners. A lot of people sent in their names, but only two could win, and I'm pleased to announce that the first goes to, and I'm sure I'm going to wreck this name because it's a tough spelling, Arjan Labruyere, who says he lives near Belgium. Well, he knows I have a soft spot in my head for Belgians, I guess, right? Anyway, the second goes to Elsie Escobar of yogeek.me. Elsie's a yoga instructor who loves technology. You really got to go check out her site. Again, it's yogeek.me. Congratulations to both of you. I'll hook you up with Guru. We'll get that whole thing done. Well, Paul Burns called in with possibly the shortest ever application review I've heard. Let's listen in. Now, don't let your mind wander because you'll miss it. It's 47 seconds long.
Hey, Allison. I was taking a walk this morning, and I thought of something that the listeners might want to know. If you have an iPhone 3GS and you have mobile photos with an F, it costs $2.99. It's an application. You can easily upload your video up online, and it's great for archiving and high quality video, unlike YouTube where it compresses the heck out of it. Anyway, mobile photos with an F, it's a good app, it's $2.99, and it has solved a lot of my archive problems, especially if you want long term and you don't want to go over your MobileMe account limit. Anyway, thanks for the NoSilicast, and hope you had a great vacation.
Well, Paul is a man of few words, but he did include a link in his email to the iTunes store for mobile photos and a link to his Flickr gallery he made with mobile photos, so I put that in the show notes. Thanks a lot, Paul. Well, for a slightly longer review, Scott Rutowski joins us to talk about Ootunes Radio for streaming audio for the iPhone.
Highlighted button.
G'day, Allison and the NoSilicast podcast listeners. Today I'd like to review another radio application for the iPhone called Ootunes Radio. Now, listeners would remember the last review I did, which was on TuneWiki, but I'd like to say that I've found this new Ootunes Radio application to be even better than TuneWiki, and I'm now going to explain why. Now, I've been doing a bit of research on radio streaming applications for the iPhone, and basically, I think that's interesting to note is that certain applications that stream audio on the iPhone use more battery life than other applications do. Reading a review of different streaming applications on the phone, the top two applications was another application which I haven't even tested called F-Stream, but I'm not really too concerned with that. And second was Ootunes Radio. Now, the thing I like with Ootunes Radio is the fact that the developer, firstly, is very, very keen to make this application work with VoiceOver on the iPhone. The other thing is that there's some really cool radio streams. I think he said last we looked, there's 11,000 different streams in Ootunes Radio that you can listen to. Also, which was cool, the application has a facility to stream your streams that you're listening to using Safari. So you can stream in the background while you're doing other tasks on your iPhone. The audio quality from Utunes is very, very crisp. It's very, very clear. And it just works very, very well. Thousands of different kinds of streams you can listen to. There's talk, music, different genres, and decades like 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, etc. I'd like to encourage everybody to go to the iTunes store and do a search for Utunes, OOTUNES, Utunes Radio. The current version is 2.1, and it's a great app. It costs $5 US to buy, but it's definitely worth every cent that I've spent on the application. So definitely check it out, Utunes Radio. Thank you very much for listening, and we will be back with more reviews soon. Thank you.
Dimmed image. Pause. Stop. Button.
All right, it sounds like Scott's specialty is as our iPhone streaming audio professional here. Thanks a lot, Scott. Appreciate all your reviews. So it's become a lovely internet joke that I'm impaired time zone-wise, but I still contend that it's really, really hard, actually. Last week, Alistair from New Zealand sent in that great explanation of how to use GMT to use the math, which if I practice, I might be able to get it to work. After hearing that, Nick Brennan tweeted me asking, why don't you just use the world clock widget on OS X? That allows you to set clocks to all different cities. Well, I explained that I do use that, but that only tells me what time it is now in those other cities. What I need is something to tell me what time it will be in the future. So, for example, if I ask Nightwise to meet me at 10 a.m. my time on Saturday, what time and what day will it be in Belgium? Well, Nick was not to be dissuaded, and evidently he's a big old dashboard widget hound because he found the perfect tool to fix my time zone issue. I am completely released now. I'm in heaven. He found a dashboard widget called Time Scroller from timescroller.com. You open the dashboard, flip it over, and choose your home city. Next, add cities by continent. Now, this was a little bit troublesome for me because I'm actually worse at geography than I am at time zone, so I had to go, okay, what city would be in Belgium? But I eventually found Dublin for Bart, Brussels for all of my Belgians, Hobart, Australia for Rose, and Perth for the curiously silent lately, Jane. Once you put in all your cities, you can flip Time Scroller back over, and now it'll show the current time next to your location and the relative times in all the other cities. Okay, so far it's just like the world clock, but this is where it gets good. On the bottom of the window, there's a slider. Grab that bad boy and slide it to the right, and suddenly the time and day starts advancing in all the cities at once. You can drag as far as 3 days in advance and see what time it'll be in those cities when you get to the time you want in your own time zone. This is so awesome. I kind of wished it would advance a week, but then again, I can pretty much figure out the day myself, except for that whole Australia being a day ahead thing. Oh man, I just flipped it over again, and it turns out there's a whole slew of cool options to play with, one of which is setting how far in advance it can go. Awesome, I can set it for 7 days, or even 30 if I wanted to, but I bet precise scrolling would get very hard to do. Well, Time Scroller has another cool feature. There's a tiny little mail icon in the bottom left. So, you know, I clicked on it. It launched my mail client, set the title to A Good Time for That Call, and in the body of the email, it put the name of each city and the time and day for the call. This is so slick. They really thought of everything. They even let you set green, yellow, and red times. So as you scroll, you can see if it's showing a reasonable time in each city. Now, this would work for most normal people, but the reason Bart and I can be such good friends is that I get up really early, and he goes to bed really late. So to him, a reasonable time to start a conversation is after 6 p.m. And, you know, he'll even be on live chat when it's 2 o'clock in the morning his time on a work night. Thank you so much, Nick, for finding this software for me, and I'm going to do a special shout-out to Terry over at timescroller.com for making the perfect application for me. After I took a look at this, I wrote to him and I said, tell me, what else you got? What else are you writing? Because I gotta check out everything that this guy writes. Because this is perfect. This is the greatest application. I'm so excited. No more excuses for not knowing what day or time it is. Well, I don't think we've reviewed enough applications that allow you to create snippets of text with short keystrokes. Do you? I mean, come on, seriously. We've only done like RapidoWrite, Text Expander, Presto, KeyXL, Texter. I can't remember all of them, but the list is far too short, don't you think? This week I started testing out Typinator from Macility.com, M-A-C-I-L-I-T-Y, Macility.com. Anyway, I watched the great introductory video on the Macility website, and that got me really excited. But I found even more cool options when I dug into the software on my own. Typinator is, I'm not quite sure what kind of application it is. I know it's a menu bar app because I can see it up there, and I can launch it with Quicksilver, but it doesn't show up like if I do a command tab as a running application, and it's not a preference pane. So I don't really know what kind of an application it is. The window for Typinator has three panes vertically. The first pane shows you all of the abbreviation sets that you have. Sets are snippets that are organized essentially in folders. If you click on one of your sets in the top pane, you can see all of the snippets for that set down in the second pane. They show you the abbreviation, the expansion, a symbol to tell you whether it requires the case to match to make the snippet work, and then another symbol to tell you whether the whole word is required. Not sure what that even means, but they have a symbol right there for it. You just get a short blue bar if it's not the whole word and a long bar if it's the whole word, but I don't know what they mean by whole word. Anyway, finally, in the bottom pane, you have an area where you can create and edit snippets. You type in the abbreviation you want to use, and then you type in the expanded phrase. You can choose plain text, rich text, or get this, you can insert pictures too. I tested Typinator using my signature as a graphic, and it worked easily. Instead of having to browse to an image, you just paste it right in there. I know browsing isn't all that hard, but how many times does it happen that you just got the graphics ready and then you realize you have to browse to it, but you just had it right there. You could have copy-paste. Instead, you got to like go navigate to it. It's kind of a pain. So I like the way Typinator did it with the paste. They've also included some predefined sets that you can add to Typinator, like an auto-correction set for U.S. or British English, French or Dutch. This is really cool because they've built in over 800 commonly misspelled words, and you can even add your own to the set. For some reason, my brain always spells manager as manger, and it turns out manger doesn't really come up all that often except in December. I added that misspelling to Typinator, and it worked like a champ. Now, that did create a problem for me because I needed to write up the show notes where I was going to try to write manger. How can I type manger if I told it to always change it to manager? Turns out that if it changes the word for you and you back up and repeat the typing the way you meant to do it, it leaves you alone. I love that they included that logic. That's actually something nice I have to say about the BlackBerry. That's the way it works there too. On the BlackBerry, I know that every time I write HR, it changes it to hour, even though if it's in the middle of a word. A lot of times I'm trying to abbreviate human resources and it turns around and changes it to hour, but if I just back up, it fixes it. Well, I have to take a little break in explaining how Typinator works to talk about the sounds it makes. If you do a snippet in a regular set, it makes this very pleasing click sound. It's very, very happy little sound. When I use the autocorrect feature, it made this snotty little buzzer sound like, eh. You know, I don't want to be yelled at when I misspell. Just go clean it up for me. I discovered in my tried and true poking around methodology that you can change the feedback sound from a bunch of different options, many of which are not standard Mac OS X noises. My personal favorite when I do a misspelling is, uh-oh. I love it. It sounds so funny. It makes me laugh every time. It's confusing Steve, of course, because he thinks I'm making that noise. Well, I also found an option to count replacements as expansions or corrections, too. So apparently it's keeping track of how many expansions it did for you and how many corrections. All right, back to the review. They also have predefined sets for FileMaker and Tidbits, neither of which I use, but apparently that must be a big deal. There must be things you always use in there. What I do use is they have HTML snippets. That could be really handy. I've defined a few of those myself in other tools, like the one I use to align images in my blog. It's really long and complicated. Bart wrote it for me. Anyway, this is a great time to point out that a most excellent feature of Typinator. You can create snippets that leave the cursor somewhere other than the end of the text. So imagine you want to create some bold text in HTML. I'm not going to get into all the details because it's hard to explain out loud, but to make text bold in HTML, you put some symbols on either side of the text. If you use the snippet from Typinator, you can have it put the symbols in place and then leave the cursor between the two symbols so you can type in the text. That's really handy. I'm not sure who needs this, but there are presets for superscript and subscript. I guess if you find yourself cubing things in your text all the time, that could come in really handy too. Typeinator allows you to import snippets from other applications. I'm not sure how many different ones it can do, but I tested it with Text Expander, and it worked like a champ. I tested to see what would happen if I imported a set of snippets from Text Expander, and I didn't shut Text Expander off. And shockingly, everything I type is doubled now. I don't recommend that, of course. I had to turn that off. Well, there might be times you'd like to limit a set of snippets to only one application, or just a couple. And Typeinator, it turns out, lets you do that. The default is that all sets work in all applications, but you can add any running application and tell it which sets work on that. And then all other applications get the rest of the sets. It's kind of weird that the application has to be running in order to have the snippets work with it, but it works easily and intuitively. I mean, you can understand what they're doing. As hard as I tried, I could not find anything the Typeinator couldn't do that I wanted it to do. I couldn't get anything to break. I could get no flaws out of this thing. There wasn't anything I couldn't figure out how to work. The application worked flawlessly. Typeinator will run you 20 euros, which is around $29 US today, for a single user license. You can get a two-pack for 35 euros, and they have 5 and 10-pack prices as well. Check it out at macility.com. Now, you guys know that I'm a huge fan of screen steps, right? Well, you may have heard me mention it once or twice. Just in case you're new here, Screen Steps is a fantastic application to assist you in the creation of lessons and manuals for documenting things you do on the computer. It runs on both Mac and Windows, and it's probably in my top 5 applications I use today. I love any excuse to teach how to do things on the web or how to use applications, so having a tool that makes it easy and fun and intuitive actually makes me do it even more. The best way I can prove this is that a long time ago, I planned to do a tutorial on how to make an audio recording using the free Audacity and then export it out to an MP3 file for a podcast. I planned it. I strategized. I thought about it, but I kept not doing it because the only tool I knew to use was Microsoft Word, and I knew that by the time I was done, I'd begin drinking heavily if I tried. I dreaded it. And then along came Screen Steps, and I finally got off my lazy butt and got it done, and I enjoyed myself doing it. You can see how great the output is from Screen Steps by going to podfeet.com and clicking on the tutorials link in the right-hand sidebar. Just look around there till you find Audacity in the list. I'm so happy I finally got this done, and I have Screen Steps to thank for it. If you're in the same boat as me doing tutorials for people all the time or wishing you had the energy to do them, check out the free 30-day trial at screensteps.com. And then when you realize you love it, remember to use the coupon code NOSILLA, that's my name spelled backwards, all capital letters, for 25% off. If you do that, the regular version is only $30. Then the pro version comes out only $60. All right, BJ from North Carolina is joining us with a review of his newest toy.
Hello, Allison, and the rest of the NoSillaCast community. This is VJ from North Carolina trying out my new Logitech ClearChat Comfort USB headset. First, let me start off with a problem that I had. Ever since I got my MacBook, I really love to record audio of myself speaking, but my audio was always really awful because I was using the built-in iSights microphone, which picks up everything. The Logitech ClearChat Comfort USB headset definitely fixes that problem in spades, especially if I use a track specifically designed for use in noisy environments. The ClearChat Comfort is definitely very comfortable for me to wear, and it doesn't require a rocket science degree to operate, although it takes a lot to set it up in the various applications that you will be using. One major downside is that it picks up noise like you wouldn't believe if you are using a regular track with no noise reduction effects inside GarageBand, which I won't be doing, as that will make my recordings absolutely unlistenable. One other downside is that it records in mono, but you probably wouldn't have known that unless I told you. So now I guess I'll be doing a lot more reviews for the NoSillaCast now. I'll definitely be continually searching for stuff to review. So, until next time, this is BJ from North Carolina, signing off.
Hey BJ, thanks for the review, and I'm glad you got some good equipment. It sounded great. You know, I checked out the Logitech ClearChat USB headset, and it runs $32 US at Amazon, so I put a link in the show notes to it if somebody wants to pick one up. One thing to point out, there's no reason for a USB headset mic to record in anything but mono. You're the only voice coming from one direction. What value would there be in making this a stereo recording? Headset mics are made to be sensitive to sound coming straight towards it from the side towards your mouth, not to pick up directional sound from other areas. So stereo would simply make the audio file twice as big with zero value to the listener. I am curious why you're saying it picks up a lot of ambient sound only in GarageBand. That seems kind of funny. Perhaps I'm misunderstanding you. Anyway, it sounds a lot better than the internal mic, so that's great news. Right before we left on our trip, I remembered that ages ago I got a small device that might just be really useful for travel. It's called the Power Stick from EcoSol. It's a stick about 4 inches long, sort of looks like a USB stick, but thicker and longer, maybe the size of a pack of chewing gum. You plug it in via USB to charge it, and then you attach the adapter cables to fit your device. On the opposite end of the power stick is a jack. It's like a stereo mini jack, but even smaller, eighth-inch jack, maybe? Anyway, the power stick comes with 8 different adapter cables, each of which has that small pin jack on one end, and the other end is every single electronic connector I've seen in the last 5 years, and some I've never even seen before. I'm serious. They've got a dock connector, a mini USB, a micro USB, and 5 more I don't recognize. According to their picture, they're for Sony Ericsson, LG, Samsung, Nokia, and the Palm Trio, which I think is the micro USB connector. If you've got something weirder than that, I guess you're out of luck. The power stick has a nice charge indicator on it. Hit the button and a gray LCD scale display showing you how many bars you have left. The power stick supplies 700 milliamps of power. To give you an idea of how much that is, I know the IV charger for the iPhone from FastMac gives you 3,100 milliamp hours, which is 2 full iPhone charges. Something to give us a little bit of a scale. So this is a little under a half a charge of an iPhone. Enough to get you through an emergency, but not enough to rely on for a full-day conference, for example. Other devices like iPod Nanos wouldn't need near as much power, so your mileage, of course, will vary. Also imagine you're like, say, Don McAllister, and you've flown all the way to China, and you realize you don't have the charger for your camera. If you always kept your power stick in your bag, you'd have some method to get the job done. The power stick is very light. It only weighs 40 grams, which is 4.1 ounces, and it has a great form factor. This got me thinking about the MiFi. Remember I've been in search of a charge-only cable? Well, essentially, I have one in the power stick. I can charge the power stick off my laptop and then plug the micro USB end into the MiFi, and I think I could charge the MiFi maybe even while using it. I'll have to test that out. You know, at 40 grams plus the tiny cable, it might be worth adding to my gadget bag. I mean, ladies' purse. You know, now that I think about it, why do I carry a purse and pretend it's an elegant handbag? Why don't I just get a small geeky backpack and admit who I am? Gotta work on that. Well, anyway, now that I bring up the charge-only problems on the MiFi, I want to mention that Drew, who sent me the hack to the USB cable, heard I was having trouble with that method, and he sent me a link to a site called PreCentral, where they have a charge-only cable for $13, which is micro USB for the Pre. I went ahead and ordered it, so we'll see if that works out. The only thing I'm worried about is they don't tell me how long it is, so my luck is it's going to be like 12 feet long, which won't fit well in my elegant lady's handbag. The one that comes with the MiFi is under a foot long, so it's like 2 folds and boom, you're done. Well, fingers crossed that this one is short too. I'll let you know how that works out. So back to the power stick. I think this is a great travel device that will be in my travel gadget bag from now on. You can pick one up through my Amazon affiliate link, if you'd like to help the show, for $49.95. It's not cheap, but if you're about to see the terracotta soldiers in China with Leo Laporte and you find that you forgot to bring your camera charger, would $50 be too expensive? Matt Hillier of the Stealth Mac podcast joins us for a review of the TomTom iPhone application.
Hey, Allison, Matt Hillier here from the Stealth Mac podcast, back this week for a review for TomTom for the iPhone. The TomTom turn-by-turn navigation application from TomTom International was released to much anticipation on Monday, August 17th. It retails for $99 US, and at this price, some people met it with some mixed emotions. Personally, I expected something like this for a price point, and I eagerly handed iTunes my credit card information in exchange for a rather large download, about 1.2 gig. It took about 45 minutes to download and install on my iPhone. Now, my personal experience with GPSs has been limited to the Garmin StreetPilot 2820. This external dash mount GPS receiver has Bluetooth XM radio capabilities, and I've been using it for about 2.5 years. I honestly have no issues with this device, and my only gripe, as with any other GPS unit, is the yearly map updates that have to be purchased. Okay, well, how does it work? Well, pretty much just like every other GPS unit. Upon launch, you are greeted with the main menu. From there, you can choose destination, change routing options, mute the sound, change from day-night mode. Why this isn't triggered by sunset like every other GPS unit, I don't know. Switch to 2D maps, perform advanced planning, browse the map, manage favorites, call the current POI or point of interest. There is an option called TomTom Car Kit, but it doesn't do anything, and the last choice on the main menu is change settings. The goal of this review is to give you an overall review of the application in action, so I will not detail each menu. Just the most common ones used in day-to-day operations. Well, at least day-to-day for me. Route planning. The first thing you'll want to do is choose a destination to route to. To do this, tap on the Navigate to on the main menu. From there, you'll get a menu to choose Home, and you can set this under the Change Settings in the main menu, Favorites, Addresses, Recent Destinations, Point of Interest, Point on Map, and lastly, to a contact from your address book, which I find rather handy. For the last 2 days, I've been on the road, driving to various customer sites and hotels. So Monday evening, I left Iowa City and headed to Fremont, Nebraska. I had someone at work make reservations for me while I was on the road for the Holiday Inn Express in Fremont, but I didn't have the street address handy. Now, I realized I could have used Google Maps to look this up, but that would have kind of defeated this whole purpose. So I launched the TomTom application, chose Navigate to, and chose a point of interest. From there, you are presented with a POI list. I chose point of interest and city and came up with a search box for me, and I typed in the city. This filtered by state, so you need to make sure you are on the correct state beforehand. At first, this kind of tripped me up a bit because the button wasn't obvious. A few other notes here. When you select the state, the menu is actually labeled as Select Country. Also, when you're in certain cities like Des Moines, it gives several options for Des Moines, like Des Moines Batavia, Des Moines Cantrell. To find the correct city in this case, I actually had to get the zip code for my destination. Not sure what the guys at TomTom are thinking here, but this is really confusing, and comparable GPSs that I've used just don't do this. Okay, so back to finding my route to the Holiday Inn Express in Fremont. So I chose the state, or country in this application, of Nebraska, and tapped in Fremont. Then it took me to another menu that allowed me to search, choose motel, hotel, gas station, and a few other categories. You can set what categories you want to display here by tapping the More choice at the bottom of the menu. I chose Hotel Motel, and it listed the hotel motels near the city of my choice. From here, I scrolled until I found Holiday Inn Express and tapped it. I clicked Done, and it calculated and created the route. Another gripe here is I couldn't find a way for the app to give me the specific street address of the point of interest. It would give me the street that it was on, the option to call the point of contact, or the point of interest, I should say, but not specific addresses. Other units do this. Why can't the TomTom? After the route was calculated, I headed on my way. Navigation. As I headed out, I was playing podcasts in the background and had TomTom app running. This seemed like a perfectly viable way to work. The only thing here is you have to quit the TomTom application to make any iPhone or iPod changes. I don't fault TomTom for this. The ability to multitask on the iPhone has always been crippled by Apple. On the Garmin unit, they have a nice music button on the map that takes me right to the music player. I can change any settings, and then I just hit the map button to get back. I wish TomTom could have something like this. The voice prompts were good. They were a little different from the Garmin, and I made a few errors when driving. Once I got off at the exit before I was supposed to, and the second time I used the incorrect freeway interchange. I don't really blame TomTom for this. Really, every GPS unit has its own way of giving directions and its own nuances, and it takes a bit to adjust to. That's all. The only request I have for TomTom here is somehow integrate a store in the application so I can download different voice packs. I really want Homer Simpson. The app ships with the standard male and female voices of various languages. The one I used, Lori, was clear and quite understandable. While using the unit I had it mounted to the windshield using a third-party adapter. I initially used the application in landscape mode, but a few gripes here. Every other app I wanted to use remained in portrait mode, so I was kind of stuck reading and interacting with the phone sideways while it was mounted. And since my mount did not swivel like the upcoming TomTom Car Kit, I ended up just using the phone in portrait mode just to make everything easier on myself. While using the app, you can receive phone calls, and this will quit the application. After you answer the call, however, you can go back into the main menu via the home button and then relaunch the application. Also, while listening to podcasts, the application will pause the audio of the podcast music while giving the directions, then resume the music or podcast when complete. I rather like this, but I've heard other people on Twitter complain, and they prefer it would just dim the music or lower the music in the background while the announcements are being made. Also, while driving with the unit, I found a neat feature. The speed is displayed in the lower left corner. If TomTom knows the speed limit of the road you're on, it'll display the speed compared to the speed limit. For example, 63 out of 65 miles an hour. If you exceed the speed limit by more than 5 miles per hour, then the speed limit display turns red. I thought this was rather handy when driving through areas that were unfamiliar and the speed limit signs were nowhere to be found. Conclusion. TomTom is not new to the GPS game. They've been around for a while and know how it's done. As a 1.0 app, I have to say I'm impressed. I did find a few glitches with it, such as states being labeled countries, but overall the app is ready for prime time. The TomTom application for iPhone is a solid replacement for a dedicated GPS unit, and I foresee the next versions of the application only getting better. Like maybe a store for voices within the application? For the latest tech news, tips, tricks, and how-tos, please visit my podcast, thestealthmac.com. You can also find it in iTunes. Just look up The Stealth Mac. You can reach me via email. It's matthew.hillier@mac.com. Or you can find me on Twitter. It's BLDNGNERD. As always, it's been a pleasure. Thanks, Allison.
Thanks, Matt. I love your reviews. Now, I really don't get why TomTom went with the $100 price tag here. If I can get a dedicated system that does everything and includes the hardware and the mount for not much more than that, why would I want to use my iPhone for navigation? I do get the whole integration of devices thing. I mean, that's what really makes the iPhone amazing. It's so much more than a phone, but this one seems really out of bed price-wise to me. The only thing that really intrigued me about the TomTom from your description was that it stops the music or podcast when giving directions. Steve and I constantly get angry at our built-in nav system because it does just dim the voice of the podcast, but that means we miss things. We've actually gone as far as to change our nav system to give us minimal directions so we won't miss an important point in a podcast. I guess in our world, we'd rather get the podcast and miss the turn. Oh, well, that's just us. I suppose for music, which you listen to over and over again, dimming the music makes a lot more sense, but for spoken word, I think TomTom went the right direction. Do you get your car serviced regularly? I know, it's kind of like getting your teeth cleaned. It's uncomfortable and inconvenient, and it's time-consuming, so you procrastinate until they nag you to get it done or until something really bad goes wrong because you did procrastinate, right? Well, guess what? I get my car serviced regularly. Very regularly, and it's never inconvenient, and it's never uncomfortable, and it's never even time-consuming. Want to know why? Because I have always owned Hondas and Acuras so that I can have Honda Bob come over to my house to service my cars. I never, ever go to some stinky place and waste half a day driving back and forth and begging rides. I never worry I'm getting ripped off, either. I actually look forward to having my car serviced because I know Honda Bob will do a perfect job, will not charge me an arm and a leg, and I can sit and relax in my own house while he does all the heavy lifting. I actually, and I'm not kidding, I'm not joking, I'm not making this up, I will not buy a different brand of car because then Honda Bob wouldn't take care of me. I think I'm joking, but 30 years of loyalty speaks for itself. If you live in the LA or Orange County areas and drive a Honda or an Acura, give Honda Bob a call at 562-531-2321 or send him an email at hdabob@aol.com. HA Bob's Mobile Service is not affiliated with Honda, Acura, or Honda Worldwide. It's time for another exciting episode of Chit Chat Across the Pond with Bart Bouchas from BartB.ie. How are you this fine August evening?
I'm grand. It's not so fine an evening here. Anyway, this morning for you. But no, we had an absolutely gorgeous day today. Really nice in the morning. And then by the time I got out of bed, got, you know, dressed, had breakfast, had to do a couple of chores around the house, and all the time the sun was shining, and then pretty much the moment my backside hit the saddle of the bike, it got crap.
Aww, did it start raining?
No, just overcast and windy, and apparently we're in for a storm tonight.
Yeah. Yay again, huh? Well, I do want to warn the audience, just in case they do hear some weird grinding noises, my next-door neighbor is having her pool resurfaced. Yesterday, I was trying to work from home, and they were using jackhammers to grind off the entire surface.
Ouch.
So I can hear the grinding noise, but Bart says he can't. So hopefully you guys can't either, but just in case, it's not my fault.
Yeah, I'm listening carefully here. I'm hearing nothing funny, so.
Okay. I'm not that funny today, huh? All right. I'll try to take it up a notch. All right. What do we have for security light this week, Bart?
Okay. Nothing that I remember crossed my radar. I'm not sure if that's just because I've gotten forgetful and my whole workflow is still up in the air since NetNews Wire is still up in the air.
Yeah.
But I don't remember anything important happening, so I'm going to assume nothing important did.
All right. Good, good. So we can get off the security topic quickly?
No. Sort of security heavy this week. No security light, just the security takeover.
Oh, no.
Oh, no, it's good stuff.
Okay.
So we start off with a question from George from Oklahoma City. Hi, Allison. George from Oklahoma City here. Just found out about this security issue that I had never heard of before, and he links to a blog post on FlashPlayer titled Flash Player Cookies, Our Unknown Web Tracking System. I'd love to hear Bart talk about it in a future podcast. Once again, thanks for the great podcast and all the enjoyment you bring to your listeners. Take care, George from Oklahoma City.
How nice. Your fans.
Yes, very nice. My first reaction is, this is neither new nor unknown.
Oh.
I'm not entirely sure why the media got themselves on a flutter over this now, all of a sudden.
What is it?
Security community have been talking about this for ages.
Okay.
Just to prove that we've been talking about this for ages, if you go back to Security Now, episode 168, back from October 2008, there's a whole discussion on it there.
But what is it? What's the subject?
Okay, so we all know about cookies in web browsers.
Yeah.
But perhaps just a quick recap, the idea is that web servers and web browsers have no real way of keeping any sort of state. Every time you talk to a web server, it's a completely new transaction and it has no idea who you are. So to get around that problem, the concept of a cookie was invented. And the idea is that a web server can give your browser a cookie, and the next time your browser goes back to that same web server, it offers the cookie back. And so the web server stores stuff on its end and it uses the cookie as the key. And your browser just hands that cookie over and back to say, yeah, hello, it's me again. Do you remember me from last week? You know.
And it somehow knows you by your IP address?
No, by the cookie. The cookie is the identifier.
Oh, the cookie's is saved in the browser.
Your browser saves the cookie, and every time you talk to that server, it offers it back the cookie that the server had given it.
Okay. All right, gotcha.
So it's like a token that the web server gives. The web server writes something that it knows how it is going to refer to you as and says, here, you hold on to that, and then the next time you talk to me, give me that back so I know who you are.
Okay. Makes sense.
Yeah, now, there are very good uses for cookies, because without them, we wouldn't have the concept of a session. So you can log into a website and then continue to interact with the website, but every time you click on a button, that's a new page load, which is completely independent from every other page load, so without cookies, you would have to log in every time you did anything.
Ugh.
It's impossible. So okay. The only way we can get a sense of state is by having these cookies. So they're vitally important, but they're also horribly abused.
Nice.
So websites that would like to see what you're doing hand out cookies, often in banner ads and things. And so every site you visit where the same banner ads from the same companies are, that same cookie gets handed around, and they build up a profile of every website you visit, basically.
Okay. Starting to sound like a privacy issue?
It's a serious privacy issue. So people have got it beaten into them that they should disable cookies. And they, well, not necessarily disable cookies, but they definitely need to disable something called a third-party cookie. So if you go to google.com and google.com tries to give you a cookie for doubleclick.com, that's a third-party cookie because you haven't gone to doubleclick.com. You went to Google.
Oh, okay. So just because DoubleClick has an ad there or something like that, you wouldn't want to give them your information?
Exactly. So that's called a third-party cookie. And okay. Safari and a lot of other browsers disable those by default. And that's a good thing.
Maybe we should sneak in that bit about GarageBand right at this point.
Yeah, exactly, because this is exactly what the GarageBand flaw. I think it was about 2 weeks ago, there was a security update to GarageBand, and at first that made me scratch my head and go, a security update? To, like, music editing software? But for some reason, that is still not clear to me. GarageBand decided it would be fun to play with your cookie settings in Safari. Obviously, maybe it has something to do with some of its new fancy features where you can buy music lessons online or something.
Yeah.
But for some reason, GarageBand felt the need to go and tinker with your web settings. And the idea was that it was supposed to tinker with them, do whatever it had to do, and then put them back the way it found it. Only it didn't do the latter. And what it actually did was it allowed third-party cookies.
In Safari. So even though the default condition for Safari is to block third-party cookies, it switched it to where it was saying, sure, everybody can join.
Yeah, free-for-all here. Everybody in. We welcome all.
Now, I'm late to the party on this because I was in Hawaii, and I was 2 weeks late listening to the Mac ReviewCast. But I listened this morning to this thing, and I'm going, what the heck? So I just checked my Safari, and sure enough, all cookies, everybody come in.
Yeah, I think it must have happened though, one of the weeks I wasn't on the show and you had a spare Belgian. Because I definitely would have talked about this, because this one really made me scratch my head.
Okay. So everybody go check your Safari if you've been messing around with GarageBand the last couple of months, right?
Yeah, as far as I know, it's only the newest GarageBand, the one from iLife 09.
Ah, okay.
So if you're like me and you're still stuck on an old one, no worries. You're good this time.
All right. So sorry for the interruption of your flow there, but that's a perfect example.
No, it's important.
Yeah.
So we're getting used to the concept of cookies. We all know about them. They're all in our head, and our browsers give us the controls to manipulate them. We can go into the options within whatever browser we're using and delete cookies, disable cookies, disable third-party cookies, view what cookies we have. We have the control to manage the cookies. And it's in a lot of people's heads that cookies are something you should care about.
Okay.
What has been slipping under the radar for the last year or so, or more, in fact, is that there are other cookies. Our good friend Flash, that piece of... I'm going to stop that sentence because otherwise it won't be...
It's a good thing you didn't call it malware.
The argument could legitimately be made.
But you never said that.
I didn't say that, no.
Okay.
I would have said something much worse. Much more colourful vocabulary. Colourful metaphors, as Spock would call them.
Okay.
But Flash, along with its many other flaws, and there are many, Flash also keeps its own cookies, entirely independent of your browser's cookies, and they're sometimes referred to as... Wait, where's my terminology here? I wrote this in the show notes so I wouldn't forget. Flash Local Shared Objects, or LSOs.
Okay.
But they're basically cookies that Flash does. So they're either called Flash Cookies, LSOs, or Flash Local Shared Objects, but they're the same thing.
So the Flash plugin for your browser is saving those separately from the browser's cookies?
They're entirely separate, and they're cookies that Flash creates. If a piece of Flash in your website says, I'd like a cookie, please, and you then hand them over and back to the server serving you the Flash.
And what non-nefarious reason would there be for doing that?
Again, keeping state. If you're playing an online game and it keeps your score, I mean, how did it know that the last time it was you?
Oh, okay. All right.
And the answer is, it kept a cookie.
So that sounds good.
Yeah, so there are, again, legitimate reasons for this, but again, horribly abused. And unlike regular cookies, Adobe make it damnable hard to manage these. They pretty much like to pretend they don't exist. And these are now being horrendously abused. So the fashion now is to stick a teeny tiny bit of Flash into your advertisements that people won't even see. It may be like 1 pixel by 1 pixel, and it may display a little white square that blurs in perfectly with the background, which is white. But its only job is to stick in a cookie, despite the fact that you have disabled cookies in your browser.
Oh.
So because people were getting too good at managing their cookies, the SOBs who run all these nefarious advertisings and things, found a new way to pollute our machines with tracking cookies. Flash.
Nice. So what do we do about it?
We have a couple of options. First off, it is possible. I said Adobe make it hard to delete Flash cookies. They haven't made it impossible. So because these cookies are stored by the plugin, not by the browser, none of your browser's settings windows in any way control Flash, because Flash isn't part of the browser. It's just a plugin that gets loaded into the browser.
Okay.
So for reasons I don't quite understand, rather than providing an interface on your computer into this plugin, the way you do it is you go to a special URL on the Adobe, on the Macromedia website. And it's a long one, www.macromedia.com/support/documentation/en/flashware/help settings_manager07.html.
Everybody got that?
Yeah.
There is a link in the show notes.
If you go to that URL, it displays a control panel, which allows you into the secret settings of Flash. And one of the tabs in those secret settings, tab number 7, is the tab that shows you what locally cached objects or local shared objects or LSOs there are in your Flash plugin, and it provides a button to delete one, more, or all.
Wow. So you have to delete them one by one? You have to go through it?
Well, no, there's a button that said delete all.
But you'd have to do that, like, every day? Because they're getting added as you go through life?
Yep. Now, this is where people like yourself and myself would have less of an issue than others. You use Flash Block.
Right.
Which means the only Flash you see is Flash you want to see. So all of those stupid 1 pixel by 1 pixel white backgrounds for the sole purpose of tracking you, you're never going to enable those because you're not even going to notice you're missing something on the page.
Yay!
So you're only getting the Flash from things you choose. So YouTube gets to track everything you do because YouTube get to have a Flash cookie if they like. Or at least they get to track you through the YouTube site. And maybe there's other things where you actually allow Flash because it actually provides some useful functionality. So I guarantee you have some Flash cookies.
Sure.
But I guarantee you have many less than people who don't use Flash Block. Likewise, I use NoScript, and I don't allow Flash unless I need it. So again, my exposure to all this nonsense is significantly lower than people who don't use either NoScript or Flash Block.
That's great. So we'll put in links in the show notes to FlashBlock and NoScript if you guys are interested in getting those. They're both add-ons for Firefox, by the way.
Yes, and speaking of add-ons for Firefox, there's another one you may be interested in. It's called Better Privacy. And it does allow you to control Flash locally cached objects or sort of local shared objects or Flash cookies from within Firefox. Now, this plugin comes with a warning. Its default behavior is to auto-delete all Flash cookies on exit.
Oh.
Now, this has the very large advantage of being a set-it-and-forget-it technique. It has the very large disadvantage that if you happen to enjoy playing online games that keep your score inside a Flash cookie and stuff, you're going to be back on level one every time.
Okay, so maybe not.
But you can control its behavior by going into tools-better-privacy, and then it gives you a whole GUI there where you can control how it behaves.
Oh, fantastic.
So, I mean, it's good. It lets you customize it, but its choice of default is not the choice I would have made.
Okay.
So it's just important to just stress that. So if people do install this, go into the settings and make sure that you don't, you know, that it's doing what you'd like it to do. For 99% of people, it's probably fine to just delete them on exit every time. I don't think that many people depend on Flash cookies, to be honest. But some of our younger people who, I mean, Flash games are apparently all the rage, so they may get very grumpy if suddenly they lose all of their settings on all of their games.
Good to have that warning. And you did put a link in the show notes to that, so that's perfect.
I did. Something I didn't put in the show notes, but which I do want to mention, just because I'm in a ranting against Flash mode. There are many arguments to be made against Flash, and one thing you can certainly make against it, especially in recent times, is its record on security has been abysmal. Like, absolutely nothing short of abysmal. So that in itself is reason enough to always deploy Flash Block or NoScript, and reason enough not to use Safari, because you simply don't have that control. But something that made me laugh a lot is they decided that in the midst of all this carry-on, they were having to release updates every few weeks to deal with critical vulnerabilities that were in the wild, zero-day vulnerabilities. Their solution was, those Microsoft people, they've managed to get a really good thing going with these Patch Tuesdays, and everyone understands it, and everybody likes it, and it all makes perfect sense. Why don't we do the same? Only, once a month is so much work. Why don't we hold back all of our updates and do them quarterly?
Are you serious?
I am serious. To say that it was ridiculed within the security world is putting it mildly.
Oh my gosh.
This policy didn't make it through one quarter. Because lo and behold, I think it was last week, there were 12 Flash thingies patched.
Oh my gosh.
Because there was more zero-day exploiting fun.
Oh my gosh. So now I've got to rewind us to the very beginning of what you were talking about, because now that I understand what the problem is, I'm intrigued that this was brought to light in Security Now back in October of 2008. So they haven't made any progress on fixing this in what appears to be like 10 months?
Mm-hmm. And Security Light didn't pick it up when it started. It just happened to mention it while they were talking about regular cookies. It just happened to come up.
You mean Security Now? You called it Security Light.
No, they're definitely Security Heavy.
Security Light is your show.
Yeah, even then it wasn't new.
Wow.
It's it's been in the tech people have known about this. I don't know what happened. I think perhaps it was the fact that someone had done a study that like X percentage of websites use this, and that caught, I think it caught on someone like the Register or Slashdot, and then the mainstream media glommed onto it from there. I think that's what happened, and I think that's why this week it's caught everyone's eye. Probably because it's a silly season and there's no real news.
It's a silly season?
Did you ever hear that phrase?
No, uh-uh.
Okay, no, it's a phrase in journalism in Ireland that, you know, the summer is the silly season and you end up with stupid things in the news, you know, Canary goes water skiing or something because there's nothing happening.
Okay.
Your Congress is in recess, our Parliament is on holidays, so it's the silly season.
Oh my gosh, that could explain something. I was watching CNN News, right? I mean, CNN, that's news, right? That's news heavy. And they had this idiot guy, Rick Sanchez, who's all about, he's on Twitter and he's on Facebook and everything. And as he reads his articles, he reads tweets that people are tweeting right real time about what he's saying. So it's pretty inane to start with, but he hit an all-time low. He was quoting from Vogue magazine about the wife of some, I don't know, congressman, senator, mayor, I don't know, who cheated on him or her and the whole thing. That's what he was talking about on CNN. He was quoting gossip. Like, it wasn't even new gossip. He was quoting from a magazine.
So maybe CNN watchers can't read or something. They need help. I don't know.
Well, I'm just not sure a lot of CNN watchers are Vogue magazine people either, or gossip people. I mean, that's
so
not what...
reading something they've chosen not to read themselves.
And talking to people on Twitter about it.
Talking, yeah, that's pretty much a low point of news, all right.
I would think I would. The silly season, I got it now.
Yeah, that's classic silly season stuff.
All right, well, this is good, though. So we've got a bunch of links to some great Firefox add-ins. Yet another reason to use Firefox. Oh, I did want to say, because someone for sure will write in, there are ways to block Flash in Safari. I've never found any of them to work particularly well, but a lot of people swear by them. So there is a way to block Flash in Safari, but Firefox is just so easy. It's like Flash block, boom, it's gone. No Flash plays unless I push the button.
The problem I have with doing it on Safari is that it's a hack. It's always a hack of some sort, whether they hack it by putting a local proxy. Like, do you remember that Glimmer blocker thing you ran into issues with?
Right, that's the one that we thought I had malware on my system because of it.
Yeah, or they either do that, or they actually hack the browser, and then some update comes along, and your whole Safari falls on its backside.
Yeah, so it's not a built-in capability to say, let's allow add-ons.
Yeah, exactly. They just don't have an architecture for it. So, yeah, people manage to hack ways and beat the system, as it were. But that's not the way I want to do security.
Yeah. All right, okay, so what else is up? We done with security yet?
No, and this one I actually had to laugh to myself when I was writing, when I was coming up with this idea, because I was in a huff about this. I was like, you know, you always say, you know, did anything blow your dress up? Oh, this blew my dress up.
Usually that's considered a good thing, not a bad thing, but okay.
Is it?
Okay. It's like, ooh, that's exciting. Well, it was exciting.
Yeah, okay, no, perhaps that's not the right phrase then. But anyway, certainly got my knickers in a twist. How's that?
There you go.
I'm a big Twitter user, but I'm not a big user of the Twitter webpage because, quite frankly, it's rubbish. Mm-hmm. To be blunt about it, I don't think it's a particularly good interface, but hey, we have clients, so who cares? But anyway, for one reason or another, I was on the web interface and I went to log in and I clicked log in and I'd finished logging in and then my brain went, ha, whoa, what just happened there? And I went through the process again just to make sure that I mean, it took a couple of minutes for it to sink in. It's not over HTTPS. It's not secure. If you go to twitter.com, click the login button, you are sent to twitter.com/login, and it's HTTP, not HTTPS. So, okay, maybe the page itself isn't secure, but maybe it submits securely to the server, which is possible, because submitting a form, displaying the form and submitting the form are two separate connections to the server. So the one to get the form and display it might be unsecure, but it might still submit it securely. So I did a quick view source to see where the form submits to, and the form submitted to http://// some URL. It submitted to /session, and /// means this is a relative URL. So for the relative URL of an unsecured URL is always an unsecured URL.
Okay. So I guess I didn't realize most. I mean, you're saying most sites that require any kind of login, you would expect them to be secure?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And if they're not, you shouldn't log into them.
Huh.
If that padlock don't show up, they're not trustworthy. So that means that your username and password are flying through the internet completely unencrypted. In plain text. So if you happen to be in any sort of internet cafe or hotel wireless or anything, anyone in the building can see your username and password. Now, we have so many logins to so many places that just about everyone reuses usernames and passwords. We all know we shouldn't, but we all do it.
Right.
So if Twitter are playing silly buggers, as it were, with your username and password like that, they're endangering you significantly.
Hmm.
And what's worse, if you actually go to the URL bar and force it to go to HTTPS, it works.
Oh, so they could be doing it as the default.
That's it. Yeah, so all they have to do is change the URL of where you go when you click the button log in. Problem would go away instantly.
So
but they choose not.
How do you tell? So, like, I'm testing TwitPic and TwitVid while we're talking. If I go to TwitPic, that's not an HTTPS thing, right? So up in the upper right, it says Twitter username, and I put in Podfeet, and then I put in my password, but I'm not on a HTTPS connection right now.
Okay, that in itself is an issue, but in theory, it may not be as big of an issue as it could be. So if you now go file and do a view source,
okay,
and then search for the word form...
Okay, that would tell
somewhere
you...
Somewhere in there, there will be form action equals something.
Okay.
Which is the URL that the details are being sent to.
Okay, this says action equals slash login.do.
Oh, it says forward slash.
Yeah.
Login.do.
Yes.
That is an unsecured login. Because the page you're on is unsecured, and that's a relative URL.
Oh, okay.
So the relative URL to an unsecured URL is always an unsecured URL.
So you would have hoped that action equals would have said HTTPS slash twitpic.com slash login.do.
Or if the homepage was on HTTPS, then a relative URL to HTTPS is always HTTPS, so it's good.
Right, right.
So on Twitter itself, what I did was I checked for the form, and it was action equals set forward slash sessions. So that means if you explicitly go to HTTPS colon slash slash HTTPS forward slash login, that relative URL is now secure.
Okay.
Because you've gone there securely, so a relative to a secure is always secure. But there is a whole raft of JavaScript if you view the source on Twitter. And in theory... that JavaScript could be sensing an unsecure connection and proactively changing that action within JavaScript after the page loads. So in theory, it could still have been good.
But it
so I said I could prove one way or the other whether it was or wasn't. So using a bit of command line hackery, I got my machine to log every single packet it sent to the secure web port, which is port 443. And so to test out my little filter, I logged into Gmail and I saw hundreds of packets go securely. I thought, okay, that's fine. So I restarted my filter again and logged into Twitter. Not a single solitary secure packet in the entire thing.
Wow. Okay.
So what I thought it might be good to do, so in the case of Twitter, the key take home is that you should make a shortcut in your web browser, a bookmark, to HTTPS colon slash slash twitter.com forward slash login. And then you'll be able to securely log into Twitter.
Oh, that's a good idea.
And I did test that with my filter, and if you do that, you do get a secure login. But there's a teachable moment here, as it were. I don't think a lot of people know the difference in secure and unsecure and why you should care. I think a lot of people at a push will say, if it's HTTPS, it means it's encrypted. But that's literally just one third of the story. So I thought it might be an opportunity to explain to people why it's important that not only does a login page submit to a secure URL, but also that the login page itself is on a secure URL. Both are actually important, even though that seems counterintuitive at first glance. Because you might say, I don't care if the page where I log in is not coming to me securely. I only care that my login details go securely.
Okay. Say that one more time. You lost me.
Okay, you would think that that you would not care if the server sending you the page on which you type in your login details in an insecure fashion, you would think that that doesn't matter. But the only thing that you would think would matter would be that when you send those details back, that that happens securely.
Okay, right.
But that's not true. So I will start by explaining what the point is of HTTPS, which you will hear some people call SSL and some people call TLS. So they're all very much related. They're technically not quite the same, but I'm not going into that here.
Okay, good, because my eyes are starting to glaze over a little.
Okay, well, there's three things that are guaranteed by this secure protocol. Only one of which is confidentiality, i.e. encryption. The other two are also important. So the first one of the three is authentication, which means that SSL guarantees that both ends are who they say they are.
Okay.
So if someone has managed to, through a DNS changer Trojan or through a DNS-based attack or through some sort of man-in-the-middle attack, if someone has managed to trick your computer into thinking that their nasty evil server is in fact www.twitter.com, if you do that securely, the security cert will not match and you will get an error. You will then know not to stick in your username and password.
Okay.
If you do that insecurely, you have no idea whether or not that really is Twitter.
Ah.
And if you do type in your details and hit enter, you don't really know where they're going to go.
Okay.
So you could be handing over your credentials to a phishing site.
You know, I can picture that happening, though, if, you know, it's not that uncommon that I might get a link or, you know, something in a Twitter client, but I end up going over to the Twitter website through that link, and now I've gotten there through somebody else. I'm not clicking a bookmark in my browser.
Okay, even if you do click a bookmark, you still don't know for sure that you've actually gone to Twitter.
Well, but
there are a million and one DNS attacks.
Okay, but I'm saying if I did the bookmark HTTPS,
yeah,
like you just taught us, that one's secure. But if I follow through from somebody else, I might get into the wrong one.
Yeah, but the point I'm trying to make is that a URL with the S, you know you are talking to who the title bar of your browser says you're talking to. Whereas without the S, it could be that someone has in some way attacked you via DNS and that you're not going where you think you're going at all.
Got you.
And there are so many attacks against DNS and so many ISPs that have not updated themselves from even the well-known attacks against DNS that it's actually not valid to assume that DNS is safe.
Have you considered contacting the Twitter people about this to say, dudes?
I did, actually. I app-tweeted them.
Okay, good, good. Because, especially since they have it set up as secure, but they're just not using it.
Yeah.
99.9875% of the people on Twitter will never do what you just taught me to do.
Absolutely. Absolutely. They will go to the webpage and click the login button because that's what you do.
Right, right.
So authentication is the first thing that HTTPS gives you, which is why it's important that the login page itself is HTTPS as well as where it submits to, so that you have confidence that you really are talking to Twitter, that you're not about to give your username and password to a bad guy.
Okay.
And don't rely on what the address bar says of your browser. That can be faked.
Right.
The SSL certificate can't.
Okay.
The second thing it ensures is confidentiality, which is encryption. In other words, it guarantees that the only two people who can see what you send over a secured connection is the people on each end, you and the server you're talking to.
Okay.
The third thing it guarantees is integrity, which means that it guarantees that what they sent is what you receive, and what you send is what they receive. So an attacker couldn't inject a bunch of malware into the traffic while it's streaming to you through the internet.
No, that sounds good. I want that.
Exactly. Now, any time you go to a web page without HTTPS in front of it, it's theoretically possible for a man-in-the-middle attack to inject any code into that they want. So if you're on open Wi-Fi and you're on an unsecured network, anyone else sitting in the building can inject any code they want into every web page you visit, and it's not difficult to do.
Hmm. Okay.
Just something to bear in mind that 99% of people have no idea about. So there's a lot more to a secure web page than simply encryption.
Yeah.
There's authentication, confidentiality, and integrity. And they're three very important things.
You know, in a way, this is sort of a vote for a way around a lot of this is actually using something like the MiFi or an EVDO card, because you're never on a shared Wi-Fi network.
Okay, but there could still be malware on your machine and stuff that's doing it. Well, I suppose if there's malware on your machine, you're hosed anyway. It doesn't really matter.
Right, game over, man.
Game over, exactly. And in theory, that wouldn't protect you from the DNS servers on your ISP getting messed up. And we know that ISPs were attacked successfully with the Kaminsky DNS flaw.
Wah.
So it makes you a lot safer, right? It is very difficult to be in more danger than you are on open Wi-Fi. Very difficult.
Right.
Short of putting your username and password on a web page on the internet, I don't think you can be less secure than using unsecured Wi-Fi.
Right. Starbucks, yay! So, this is one of those depressing episodes, though, because one of the things I like about Security Lite is you tell us about something nasty and you say, here's how you fix it, and we all smile, follow the directions. But what
bookmark,
you're telling...
secure login to Twitter.
Yeah, but TwitVid and TwitPic both appear to be in the same boat, but don't... I haven't checked to see if HTTPS would work on them, but at least on TwitPic, it's definitely not secure.
This brings me to another entirely different thing. These Twitter plugin sites that ask you for your Twitter username and password, I wouldn't use them if you paid me. You're giving your login details to an untrusted third party.
But why would I trust Twitter more than TwitPic or TwitVid?
Well, I particularly think, TwitPic and TwitVid are both so high profile that they couldn't get away with... I would think that if they were caught doing something nasty, it would get so much publicity, they would be in so much trouble that they just wouldn't do it.
Okay.
However, what particularly caught my eye, and I almost did it, and I got as far as the webpage and I went, oh my God, what am I doing? Is these kind of apps like, just go to this URL, give us your username and password, and we'll turn your avatar green to help those nice people in Iran.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry. These are complete randomers in the net, and you're giving them your username and password. Are you mad?
Evidently, since I did it.
Oh, no, you didn't.
Of course I did. No, I didn't do that one. I did the one where I've got a nice little Apple logo on my avatar.
Oh, dear. Yeah, not a good idea. Anyone, if I wanted to write some malware, if I wanted to steal a whole bunch of Twitter accounts, I'd just set up a little service to do some kooky little thing. In fact, the default modus operandi of spammers is to pick on news events and use those as a trigger. So, Michael Jackson RIP would be a good one to stick in, or the Iran stuff. So... very dangerous.
Okay.
Sorry.
By the way, I just checked and TwitPic does have a secure login if you change it to HTTPS, but TwitVid appears to be spinning away when I put in the S.
Oh, dear.
So, usually the way you use something like TwitVid, though, is you do it on your iPhone. So you launch the application and shoot it up there. So
okay. That's not necessarily any better, though.
Oh, really?
Most people it's quite common to use your iPhone over Wi-Fi.
True.
There's also no reason your iPhone can't end up with its DNS botched.
I'm going to go shoot myself, Bart. I hate this episode.
I'm sorry. I hadn't actually planned that. I was planning on ending on the happy note of, see, you go to this URL and all is well in life. But
tell us a funny Irish phrase to close out or something. Give us...
I don't know, seriously, just look out for secure things. And really the point here is to explain why it's important that you do check for that secure thing. And the other thing that just springs to mind is, in work, one of the things I do when I'm configuring web servers is I actually make it physically impossible for someone to log in unsecurely by setting up a redirect on the unsecure version of the login page, so that if you try to go to it, you automatically end up on the secure version.
Hmm.
Which is how it should always be done. So it should be physically impossible to go to http://twitter.com/login. As soon as you try to go there, you should be immediately redirected to the HTTPS version. And that's a one-line configuration thing within Apache.
Okay.
Anyway, just take-home message. Go and download the Better Privacy plugin for Firefox or use FlashBlock or something. And make that URL to log into Twitter securely. Or just never use the Twitter webpage and stick to clients.
That sounds good. All right. Well, we on schedule for next week look okay?
Yes and no. Definitely sometime, but we may have to be a little more flexible with our time because in work we have, well, we have this giant new data center that's been built for us, mm-hmm. and we have our old data center, and they need to change where our electricity comes from.
So that means a sysadmin's nightmare, basically.
So that basically means no electricity for a while, followed by new electricity, which means Bart has to go into work.
Ah, okay, so we can work around that. I have Friday off, so between those 3 days, we ought to be able to pull it off.
Yeah, with the time zone, I actually think it'll be fine, because we have to go into work in the morning, and they're saying it'll be about 3 hours. So if I go into work in the morning, spend 3 hours in there, then bring everything back up, might be another hour. I'll be home by lunchtime, my time, at which time you're still lying in your bed.
Not in my world. I get up at 7 in the morning. Oh, but you're saying it will be 7 in the morning. There you go.
It will be 7 in the morning by the time I get home. Yeah, there's 8 hours between us.
All right. Well, that sounds good. We'll check in with you next week.
Indeedy. Until then, happy computing.
Well, it's nice to be back in the groove. It's been a lot of fun in the chat room. I think the Stick'em thing is working out pretty well. We had 52 viewers, 38 people in the chat room. And we got a bunch of fun people in there. We got kids in there. We're just having a ball. I'm telling you, it's a lot of fun. You should come join the live show sometime at podfeet.com/live. All you have to do is check out that website at 5 p.m. GMT minus 8. And hey, you could use the widget time scroller to figure out when 5 p.m. GMT minus 8 is on Sunday nights. All right. Anyway, keep up the great emails coming to Allison@podfeet.com. Be sure to follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/podfeet. And thanks for listening and stay subscribed.